Hello, hello, hello. Thank you and welcome for those who are just with us for this final conversation about the peer-to-peer money. I will start first by giving some rules about this open conversation because this will be driven collectively. So as we value diverse perspective, we also ask you to well speak in the microphone, to stay concise, and also to give the name of the organization, and of course your name just before talking. You are our guests. We have some beautiful special guests. We're going to talk on this topic. And I have to say that this is recorded because we want to release a podcast after Mass during the summer, I guess. So if you don't want to be recorded, well, just don't speak in the mic, sorry. So peer-to-peer is the reason why we are here today. What is this? I will just give an introduction and try to define it. And then I will ask to our special guest to give the context of their work. And then we're going to have 50 minutes for the open conversation. And please, wherever you are from, give your project, your insights, and the value is really important for us. And we start maybe to thank Satoshi and Vitalik, because without their project, we won't be here, and HCC won't be exist. They gave us the opportunity to share values and monies. Actually, the definition of money relies really on and depends on its utility. And the only public money we have is in interest bearing. I mean, it's immediate settlement. Otherwise, we do have digital means of payment, but it requires processes, KYC, and institutional supervision. And if one of all those actors fail, no one can pay or be paid. So that's why I started by saying Satoshi and Vitalik, because without this blockchain and crypto innovation, we couldn't do that anymore. Although the efficiency in payments of crypto, it's still in its infancy, but the innovation of all the ecosystem gained significant development, such as DeFi or ReFi. As you may know, DeFi, we don't like so much acronym here, so DeFi stands for decentralized finance that have made the traditional banking service available outside of traditional banks. And ReFi stands for regenerative finance. It's a new concept that emerged in 2019-2020. And it's aimed to use decentralized finance for positive impact investment. So for this final conversation of the day, we would like to question the use of money regarding the public and common good. And for me, talking about money is talking about the way we organize the access to such an asset and the circulation of it. But when we are tokenizing this activity, it brings identity, KYC matters, peer-to-peer payment, distribution, allocation of funds, collective loans, and impact measure. So defined as such, peer-to-peer money has the potential to bring significant benefits to a variety of sectors, but here we were going to question the head philanthropy with NGOs, the public services, and of course the green investment that we have. So to enhance financial inclusion, projects like Good Dollar and Celo representing here, aim to use blockchain technology to create more inclusive financial system. Because a lot of people around the world don't have access to financial services due to a variety of factors such as identification documents and trust, geographic isolation. Maybe you're going to complete all those factors. Within the NGO sector, there are challenges related to transparency, accountability, and efficiency. And it's difficult for donors also to track how their funds are being used and to ensure they're having the desired impact. I think the challenges are the same here for the green investment and the investment in general, but also for the public sector. The question of accountability, efficiency, the way citizens track how the public funds are being used is a really important matter. I think our special guests for the public sector are not here already, but I'm sure they're going to open the conversation of how the digitalized money and the tokens can be implemented and used in the public sector. Actually, it just arrived here. So cool. So all those sectors face the same challenge and limitation, and there are risks that the use of digital currency exacerbates existing inequality. Because we need technical expertise or resources to participate in decentralizing funding system, create new barriers to entry for smaller actors and network participants. And in addition, there are concerns about the potential for blockchain-based system to be used for illicit activities such as money laundering or terrorist financing. They are really tough questions. But we have the immense privilege to have incredible special guests that will give us their opinion and perspective. So we have Goodola, Cello, Tracy, and Bernard, Ackley, and Yvon that can give us insight on public services and real investment. I just have, before start, a little caveat that I would say at the beginning that we don't need to make some efforts to have a represented panel and mixed panel of girls and women, girls and men. But here we feel that we fail a bit at it. So I want to say that it's not true for the room, in fact, but yeah, for the panel, it was a bit hard to find some women, but actually they are. So
we made it.
Yeah. Keep up your spirit, sisters. That's cool. So let's start with the peer-to-peer money for unbanked people and financial inclusion. So Anna, Angelo, Christoph, what does peer-to-peer money bring that would not be bought otherwise?
Okay, hi everyone. Thank you for having us today to talk about peer-to-peer money, which is one of my favorite topics. My name is Anna Stone, and I am the executive director of GoodDollar, which is a crypto universal basic income protocol. And I'd say when we're talking about financial inclusion, there's two sides to what we're discussing. The first is actually the financial tooling itself, right? So access to digital wallets, access to new types of savings and loans, access to microcredit, which many of the people on this panel have worked on, including Jessica. And so the financial services element. And then we're also talking about monetary and asset innovation itself, right? So GoodDollar, for example, is a token that's used peer-to-peer, and the idea or the hope is that people will actually begin to innovate around the token, exchange around the token, and that money can be used as a tool to really begin to unlock value in places of our economy where fiat currency doesn't flow, if you will. And so really inverting the concept of, let's say, interest-backed money, which is what we continuously see or qualify to be money, and really innovating on the monetary structure itself. And so for me, to your question, when you're asking about financial inclusion, you know, it's interesting to look at both sides of that coin and what projects are doing, both in terms of improving access to the financial tooling through developing inherently mobile-first products that are designed to, you know, really meet people where they are, which is billions of people on their cell phones, right? But also when we're talking about the peer-to-peer money, really trying to understand how can we use this special type of blockchain technology, which enables us to create a new type of information, a new type of ledger that actually enables communities to exchange value in new ways and also design new incentive systems that aren't inherently focused on creating a profit around money, which is what we're traditionally used to.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. Very pleased to be here. My name is Angelo. I work for Celo Foundation. I'm part of like the ecosystem strategy and growth. I've been in the crypto space for 4 years, which feels like forever. Celo, for those who are not familiar, we are currently a layer one blockchain transitioning to become a layer two on Ethereum. The way that we distinguish ourselves in the space is, of course, the emphasis on, number one, emerging markets, as well as like the mobile-friendly or like mobile-first infrastructure, which facilitates or like enables everyone to like make low-cost payments. And I think this is the contribution I want to kind of like start with today. Maybe here in Belgium, or like in our experience of ETCC right now, this might not be the most relevant tooling and infrastructure. But if you go to, like, let's say, the Philippines, where I'm originally from, we have like more than 10 million overseas workers who need to send money back home because it sustains their families. You come to places where the macroeconomic contexts are a little bit more unstable, or like there's exchange rate volatility outside Nigeria, outside Venezuela or Argentina, and you need like a more stable form of like exchange. I think this is where crypto and blockchain technology really shines. I was like, you know, coming here, just looking at like my financial behavior this week in Europe, I've never really used, number one, cash. And like every transaction that I did is through a credit card or like my Apple Pay, which is kind of weird because like I'm working in crypto. I mean, like you could buy crypto there and like ETC. Buy coffee using crypto. But then with the communities that we kind of like have started to work with, like through Good Dollar, other projects in Celo, sometimes like crypto is almost like the, if not the most efficient tool, or like the, you know, a good tool for them to go on with their daily transactions. And they're not looking for complex stuff. Like they're not looking for like investments opportunities. They're looking for a way to like, one, receive money from abroad. They're also looking for a way to, you know, pay their bills or like send money to their family and friends. So like daily transactions that, again, we take for granted, especially in places where there's like more developed infrastructure. So like I think, again, that goes back to the basics of the technology. But what I wanted to emphasize also is like as an industry, we're building a new technology. But then there's also this opportunity, and this is where Celo chose to invest from day one, which is like to leverage on like the existing infrastructure right now, which is like mobile phones. We have like 6 billion users around the world. Sometimes even in developing countries, each person would have 2 to 3 SIM cards, and they would flip frequently, or like 2 to 3 smartphones, because like smartphones are like a status symbol. And so like if we really want to revolutionize our idea of access as well as like financial inclusion, why don't we leverage on this technology and enable people to create blockchain addresses with their mobile phones? And like that's one of the features of the technology of like Celo as a blockchain. anyone with like a mobile phone, like a smartphone, and not even like iPhone or like the more expensive types, but even like low cost or those that need to survive in weak internet environments, they can access the blockchain. And then they can access like all these like dApps, like Good Dollar, like Haraka, like represented by Jessica, like these financial products and services that that are being developed for them. So I think that's interesting, and I think like as we go back to like that context of like who are we building for and like who are these users, that's when, you know, I remain excited about like the prospects of this technology.
Hi. My name is Basil. I'm the founder of Tracy. So Tracy is a non-custodial wallet, very easy to use by anyone, crypto and non-crypto users. So we use the back-end blockchain in the back-end, but we keep extremely user-friendly interface for NGOs to allow to receive money, like donation, and to send money, whether simple transfers or bulk transfers from Europe to all over the world. What's interesting, let's take a use case, United Nations for Refugees wanting to send 1 million payments for refugees, let's say in Lebanon, my country of origin, for Syrian refugees. Few clicks, they can upload all the file, all the refugees information, and one click, it sent 1 million transactions towards Lebanon. People can receive money without having a smartphone, without just a feature phone, SMS, and then they can collect money at any MoneyGram location, whether in Lebanon and worldwide, which is 300,000 locations. So we mainly allow these people to be able to receive money. And we allow the sender to make it simple for them. Now, in order to send money, let's say, from France to Lebanon, you need to transact some cash, piles of cash, going to Lebanon because the financial system is collapsed, like in many countries as well, all over the world. And then there is a security requirement in order to transfer this money and then distribute cash to everyone. So we facilitate all that, and this is what we need in the system. We need something, first, very extremely user-friendly, because now when I use blockchain, I have some problems. If I need to send $10,000, first I send $10. If all okay, I send the remaining. So now we leverage only, for example, stable coins. We don't use anything else. No Bitcoin, no Ethereum, just stable coins. And we are backed by Circle for that as well, USDC and URC for Europe. And this is what I think we need to have, simplifying, getting money to the people who need the most in a few seconds without costing a fortune.
Thank you very much. We have a new special guest, actually self-invited. Welcome.
Yeah, I was the woman missing in the panel for like gender. So yes, hi everyone. I'm Jessica, co-founder of Araka. So been in the Web3 space for the past 5 years. I was actually one of the first projects on Celo at first. Really relate to what you mentioned. I was working on cash transfer for humanitarian aid and other financial services. So really saw like firsthand, you know, how blockchain technology can actually, you know, make a lot of change, especially in cases like Afghanistan and country like Venezuela as well, where it's very hard to provide assistance. Currently, I've started Araka, which is a community credit protocol. So what we do is we are connecting the RWA investor to micro entrepreneur in emerging markets in need of capital. The kind of like innovation that we're bringing here is we're leveraging social reputation as a way to better target the borrower and as an underwriting process. It really comes from the simple principle that many people don't have access to credit. There is still many people that are financially excluded, not because there is not enough liquidity out there, but because it's just too hard for traditional financial institutions to understand who is a good from a bad borrower, because there is no information out there, especially in emerging markets. So what we're trying to do is really to solve this issue by leveraging, you know, what's already happening in this community out there, so community inside, peer-to-peer voting, and so on. as a new underwriting process. So the idea is to have a reputable a reputation system that is portable, and so anyone in the world, regardless of their situation and financial situation, can access credit. And so, yeah, for me, being in the space, really blockchain space, because I really see this as an opportunity to just simply connect people to opportunities that they would not have otherwise.
Thank you very much. I'm going to the my right side to ask to Raoul, Bernard, and Yvan, what is your context? You make the bridge between the traditional finance and the Web3. What the peer-to-peer money brings that could not be bought otherwise?
I'm happy to start. So hello, everyone. My name is Raoul Ullens. I'm the co-founder of Graciago. In terms of background, I come from Bain & Company, so basically management consulting, so more of a, let's say, traditional space. And what we do with Graciago is slightly different from what you guys are doing. We really focus on healthcare, and we try and leverage Web3 within healthcare. I'm going to make it short. We tackle a problem in healthcare, which is the non-adherence problem. So in the case of a lot of chronic diseases, such as diabetes or hypertension or others, a lot of people, if not most, don't take their treatment properly. This is a very popular problem in the healthcare sector, and we've really addressed it by developing a mobile app to really target people, coach them, encourage them. But then once they take their treatment more properly, they actually make savings for Social Security because they reduce their risks of being hospitalized. And we're talking about like hundreds of billions per year in the world. So, and in Europe, it's already 150. So we try and quantify the savings a patient is going to make. And through blockchain, we actually give them back part of the savings they make by improving their behavior. So in that sense, we really try and bring a new use case within the blockchain space. I really liked what you guys said in terms of UX. It's very complex in terms of the tech stack, so technology is not there yet. And we're really driven by not improving technology, which is already quite advanced, but really trying and showcasing concrete examples of how this technology can bring a real change to the world and not only new returns on what you've put in your DeFi protocol.
Okay, my turn. Hello, everybody. My name is Bernard Nicolai. I'm passionate about finance and education. I do not know exactly in which order. It depends on the different stages in my career. What I'm doing now for the last 5 years, I lecture finance. It's 50% of my time in 3 universities, at Solvay Brussels Schools in Brussels, and also in Paris, at Paris Dauphine and at Conservatoire National des Arts et Métiers. Mainly sustainable finance on the one hand, and also the main use cases in technology and finance. So I'm very happy to contribute to such a panel, blockchain for good, because you've got the two elements. The rest of my time, I help and coach startups and scale-ups in the ecosystem. And selectively, I also invest as I'm a member of a business angel association based in Brussels. Before that, what I used to to follow a very classical career in traditional finance. So working in large groups such as BNP Paribas or Credit Suisse. And then at a certain moment in my career, I decided to quit my executive responsibilities and then to focus on education on one hand and on investment advisory on the other hand. Coming back to your question, what's the value of peer-to-peer money? So there are many ways to answer the question, but for sure, a success, if you want to implement a successful full project, there are some elements that might be common. One of them is democratization of finance, and lots of projects sponsor here, you are focusing on that. Then with peer-to-peer money, you can ensure transparency in the flow of funds, meaning that can be also a benefit for your customers. And also you can go for higher efficiency. And this is probably, those are certainly three ways to generate value. And if you reason more in terms of traditional finance, for those of you, format it like that. If you reason on the basis of a profit and loss, what could a project bring? More revenues and functionalities, okay? Less costs, also less risk relating to finance. But of course, finance is not the only element. A project can also have an impact in terms of sustainability, and then it can be relating to the E, the environment, the climate, and that was the topic of the previous panel. But it has all, it can also have a social element. So, so there are lots of opportunities relating to peer-to-peer finance for good, for sure. Maybe we are, most of us are convinced about that because that's also, that's an advantage, but also disadvantages of those kinds of meetings and sessions, and is that very often we share the same maybe values and experience, but believe me, not everybody is convinced that there is a potential for technology and blockchain in particular for doing good. So that's our collective maybe responsibility and role to educate relating to that. That's for the introduction. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me. I'm Ivan Delestois. I work at PPI France, where Noemi, we had the chance to work with Noemi also. PPI France is a mix of a development bank and a sovereign wealth fund. So we have kind of, we are highly schizophrenic sometimes because we need to do finance, but we need to develop French economy. Where we cross the path of P2P is about the financing of green finance. The state gave us 20 billions to do kind of green finance. So a bank is like, what can we do? We do loans, let's do green loans. What is a green loan? I don't really know, but we will find out. And the idea is to say, okay, it's not really working because the finance guys don't really know what is really green and what is really efficient. What ONGs knows, people on the ground knows what they're needing. So what is really interesting is about the consensus of the P2P model, where the people can say, this is useful. This is a useful transaction for society. Where banks try, but the system is very complicated. Let's put it that way, and sorry, Professor, if I make some small mistakes, but basically the central banks give interest rates to commercial banks that give interest rates to you with a delta each time. The model that could be useful for green projects would be, okay, the central bank says this is green, so it's 0.1% interest rate. This is not green. This is 5% or even 10% interest rate. The problem the central bank has and the commercial banks is that they don't know what is really green or not. And the commission didn't take any, the central bank didn't take any risk and the European Commission because they would be accused of greenwashing. So the current system is not really working. So we need to work on some kind of common basis of what's really green, what's really efficient for the society, and what's not. And that's where P2P comes in, because I think the people knows. The people can testify what is useful for society, and not, and it's funny, you have the term central bank. I mean, we're very centralized. We're linked to the French state. We're a very centralized bank. It's great to take decisions, but to measure the efficiency is a nightmare, which comes to the second use case of P2P, which is traceability. We have no vision. That was the first use case we pitched at PPI France. We give grants. Let's see where it goes with stable coins. Nobody wanted to do this because they would feel responsible. I have the data now. 70% of the grants we give are not really functioning. So, and instead of hiding it, we should improve this number. So this is why we are connected to this. Of course, it's difficult because we're a bank. We're kind of the ugly duck here. But I think we can clearly improve and we can sustain projects that are doing this way better than us.
Thank you, Yvan. You make the bring with the public sector where we have the pleasure to welcome Akli Lecoq. Can you give me the context?
Okay. I was curious about crypto a few years ago. Then I worked for the Ministry of Economy and during 6 years. And now I work for the Ministry of Interior, handling cyber threats on a central common service between police, gendarmerie, and intelligence services. But the first time I discovered crypto, it was like the hope. It was like we had ideologies in the 20th century. The two main ideologies being like socialism and liberalism, and the two are utopia that don't really exist because they rely on a third party, the central government, or letting companies doing what they want. But if you have a third party and an intermediary, you have asymmetry of information. So you have one person arranging the social relation between Pierre and Marie, and he will abuse the situation, because that's unfortunately one of the bad aspects of humanity. So the hope for cryptocurrency and for P2P, peer-to-peer money, was to erase the asymmetry of information. Anyone can check the blockchain, anyone can follow the money, and anyone can see who creates the money supply, who give the money supply to whom, and under which condition. This is cryptocurrency. But everyone is talking about stablecoin. Stablecoin is a one-to-one digital representation of another digital representation, which is the dollar, which no longer represents gold. So it's like Inception, a box in a box in a box. And the value of this so-called stablecoin represents a dollar, which purchasing power is falling. So the real hope of and the real purpose of peer-to-peer money and blockchain in 2009, at the beginning, on BitControl Forum, it was about we can create the currency, and the currency is a common good that should be on the public sector. Public sector not seen always and in the bad feeling the government, but just the people. People organize in the way they want to organize. In a Pacific anthropology, very old communities, there is no such thing as a state, but there is such thing as a common good. And what I want to say is I feel that we abandoned this hope, because now we are changing the world with stablecoin, but we don't create the money supply. So it's still the central bank of the United States who decide about the money supply. It's still created by credit. So it's still like if you're playing Monopoly, the guy in the middle of the round table is able to create any currency he wants, give it to his friend, and his friend are making loans to others and taking the interest back. So you are not doing cryptocurrency and peer-to-peer money when you are doing stablecoins. Stablecoins are not crypto assets, in my view. Crypto assets and peer-to-peer money is money where people can decide how the money supply is created. But why did we abandon that? We abandoned that, in my view, because it's the relation between law and technology. Technology is not like the only thing that can be sufficient. It's in the mind. The change is in the mind, and the retailer company, the bakery down in the streets, why does it not accept Ether or Bitcoin or nano, or I don't know, any other currency which has a different money supply than the dollar and the US, which supply is distributed in this way or another way. And the main reason is tax system, legal system, accounting rules, and we are not yet at the point where the society suffer enough for the retailer to decide to switch from the fiat currency, the centralized currency, which is losing its power, to something that is a greater currency, e.g. transparent money supply created by people.
Thank you, Akli. This is the time for the open conversation. So does someone?
Yes, maybe I have a question for Bassem. I think Lebanon is a great laboratory of the world. What happened with the financial crisis was super interesting when the classic system fails. I wouldn't dare giving information. Could you just testify about giving the different evolution, the financial crisis, the... Yes, super interested.
Yes, of course. So before 2019, everything was okay, or everything seemed to be okay, but it wasn't, because it's a country that's not producing anything, kind of anything, but still we are back to the dollar. The Lebanese lira pound was back to the dollar, but at one moment, people wanted to withdraw money through because of some political problems, and this is where the banks said, no, you cannot do it. So this is where the dollar was equivalent to 1,500 Lebanese pound. And 2 years later, $1 equal 89,000. So I can give a personal example. The salary, the retirement salary of my father was before the crisis $2,000. Now it's 50. So how can $50 afford a family of four people or five? So this was a problem, and now the crisis is still ongoing, but the situation now, everything is back to the dollar, and everything is dollar. So you cannot go and eat in a restaurant with Lebanese pound because you need a bag full of like this. We cannot do that anymore. And we don't have credit cards yet. We don't have anything. So the banking system now, we have multiple definition of dollars. So we have dollar that was stuck in the bank. We have a fresh dollar, so the dollar that you bring to the bank after the crisis, and we have what we called, we are super creative in Lebanon, the lawler. Lawler, which is the dollar of the government, because $1.89,000, it's a black market, but for the government, it's different. So they created something called lawler. So if you want to withdraw the dollar that you had before the crisis, it's like 20% of the real value. So a lot of people lost money, lost all their money, and but you go to Lebanon now and you find everyone just partying. No one knows how, no one knows why.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry. No, if you want to respond, Phil.
It was just about the same. So you said that the United Nations were able, through Tracy, your solution, to send immediately 1 million transactions. How did, I mean, I cannot believe that there is 1 million Lebanese people having a smartphone. And how could the money go to real people at the end, you see?
So we haven't proceeded yet with this. This is a use case that we are working with UNHCR. It was already tested in Ukraine, where they were able to send money through Stellar network to Ukraine. How it's possible? One, it's not about Lebanese that receive money from UN. It's about Syrian refugees, which account to 30% of the population now. 2 million refugees for a population all over of 6 million people. So this is another item that added to the crisis. And how they can receive, as simple as it is, we work with MoneyGram, it's our partner, Circle Stablecoin, and Stellar Network. So whenever an NGO issue a payment, it will go directly to MoneyGram, and it will be updated on MoneyGram ledger. So whenever someone goes to MoneyGram in Lebanon, he will see that he has $200, he can withdraw cash directly.
Thank you. And just to say that it is a huge drama. Yes. First, it's maybe there are some opportunities in drums, but it is.
Thank you. I'm Katya from Decolens. Jordan and I, we work to democratize funding for civil society and decolonize aid. The reason we do this is because money is power. And with peer-to-peer money, we are shifting the power to the people. And to add to the three, in addition to the cases you have mentioned, maybe three kind of problems that we are trying to address, but also the solutions. One is in a lot of the countries in the world today, unfortunately, governments are using money as form of financial oppression. So if they don't want us to speak up, because, you know, we are in the opposition to the government or represent movements that they don't agree with, so they will close access to our bank accounts so that we don't mobilize and stop activism, right? So peer-to-peer money has been crucial in many parts of the world just to support human rights activism. Another big part, you mentioned humanitarian assistance. So less than OECD says 3%, but actually according to the local data, less than 1% of international funding for humanitarian assistance actually goes to local groups. Why? Because it all lands and gets filtered through the first UN agencies, international, regional, and then all sort of organizations because they have the structures that they can report and blah, blah, blah. And so the groups that are actually on the ground moving the boxes, providing the shelters and all of these gets, you know, less than 1%. And the third kind of the big issue that we are working on is about the power dynamics between the global north and global south. The majority of overseas development assistance that comes today for social impact, environmental justice, actually comes from the northern governments that have their own agenda behind the money, right? So they have political, security, trades, all sort of interests behind it. So when they put the money for any project, the way they fund it is actually to preserve their control and interest over that funding. And so peer-to-peer money is also a way to shift this power dynamics, right? One important thing for me that I think we really need to be aware of, especially when I talk about transparency, is where do we, because blockchain is a tool for transparency, where do we place transparency? Where we have failed in the traditional system is that, let's say you all want to give me money so that I build this chair. So you give me money, and then the whole development assistance looks at me. Everyone puts the lens on how I look. What do I do? So this is what we called, you know, the sort of indicator reporting. How many roundtables are organized? Who did I speak to? No one actually looks at this chair, and did I build? And, you know, there are no metrics and indicators of understanding the impacts that I have created. And so we have the problem currently in the civil society financing that is driven by the interest of donors that look at me versus at the impact that I create. And so therefore you mentioned kind of the sort of impact tokenization or the different approach, right, and to creating sort of the benefits in the financing and what it actually looks on the ground and how we can use peer-to-peer money for that. So yes, all to say is that this is very crucial, not only for this kind of individual assistance, but for shifting this, creating these systemic changes that are currently in the between the global north and the global south. And it's very important for us, in addition to talking about peer-to-peer money, to think about how we measure impact and how we create systems that link that to kind of impact financing and impact tokenization.
Yes, first I have a reaction to some of the elements that you said, Yvan, and then a question for the group and for the entrepreneurs. What you said relating to central banks is very true. Huh? There is, at this stage, there are no examples of central banks promoting green finance, huh? Via interest rate and so on. However, it's a bit not their fault because it's a question of mandate. The key mandate of central banks is to fight inflation. It's quite, and when talking about finance for good, we all think about projects, impact investment, and so on, but fighting inflation is a key activity in many countries, and not only developing countries. Do you remember that between 2021 and 2023, in continental Europe, our euros, they lost 15% of value, purchasing power, and in the States, it's even more. And some complain, and it's all right, relating to the volatility of real cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and so on, but for euro, it goes always the same direction. It's worth less, minus 15%, so that's a fact. So central banks, okay. For me, there is some hope also in traditional finance. Why? Because there are initiatives from central banks, but there are also initiatives from banks, traditional banks, and some are desperate to find projects and finance them. So, and we have good example of a great bank doing sustainable finance, and it's BPI. We are all jealous in Belgium and abroad about BPI. So that's okay. Now, my question: what's your level? What's your experience? You project sponsors with development banks, government subsidies, and blended finance more generally. So the fact that some government or agencies or big donors, even in the private sector, they take a portion of the risk of your project in order for you to develop your projects and to attract more private capital, more generally, with a view to doing the world, to making the world a better place, which is your collective objective. Voilà. That's my question. Thank you. You can choose who answers. If it's all right for you, as you moderate, Noemi. It's okay.
I'll take that first, which is that I'd say I would love for someone to disagree with me, but I think there's a real dearth of capital that's willing to fund these types of experimental initiatives, and it's not without good reason. It's just that what all of us are doing is inherently experimental, and within that, there is a level of risk. And certainly when you're dealing with large-scale, I won't even talk about governmental organizations, just non-governmental organizations that are working in philanthropy, there's a real, there's not an institutional mandate to innovate or take risk. And so when you're talking about, let's say, the Red Cross, for example, which is responsible for distributing hundreds of millions of dollars in aid, the people who work at those organizations, who are the key decision makers at those organizations, there's just a bit of organizational stasis and creep that makes them unwilling or hesitant, to say the least, to experiment with new types of solutions, right? So it's the same sort of institutional laggard that you get at any sort of institution, right? I think that's even more true when we're discussing not just payment solutions, right? And actually like, okay, we're gonna distribute $20,000 to 100 people, right? That's a pilot that they might be willing to take on and they'll use, but they'll make sure that it's done in dollars, right? And they'll make sure that it's done in a currency and in a way that they can inherently explain to their donors rather than doing something a bit more innovative, which would be focusing on, say, like really supporting a community currency program where it's actually all about communities controlling the money supply, right? And so I think it's quite challenging as projects, as entrepreneurs, at least in my own experience, to now believe that that's actually the most efficient way to approach meeting people where they are. Because one of the benefits of decentralized technologies is that you can actually, through the mobile phone, reach the end user directly, right? And often in a way that's much more effective than, say, a traditional mandated program. And I think that that's actually where we're gonna see a tipping point. Not that we don't wanna work with those organizations as partners, or not that we don't wanna work with government organizations as partners, and maybe there will be effective sandbox programs that are built that actually are designed to encourage innovation. But crypto has a bad brand, bad brand. Universally a bad brand. And so even within the blockchain and innovation divisions of these large-scale organizations, there is not a big mandate to take risk. There's not a big mandate to innovate. There's a real fear around not being a bad PR story. There's a real concern around not losing donors. There's a real concern about not losing credibility. You're talking about people, for the most part, who, what the level of understanding that would be required to, in order to confidently make those decisions to take those big risks are, you know, it's just not worth the price, if you will. So I think it's a long slog to actually, like, as a project or as an entrepreneur, rely on those types of institutions as your distribution channel or as your go-to-market, because there's so many on an individual level and on a community level, they're in places that don't have money, there's a huge desire to innovate and a huge desire to experiment and a real mandate to take risk because there's very little barriers to entry. And when you see that up close, it's you want to build for the people that want to use the stuff that you're building. You don't want to build for the people that are the institutions that are already so hesitant to make a change.
Yeah, I think I will, yeah, not change anything, agree to everything that Anna said. I worked with a lot of like donors, not-for-profit. I come from the not-for-profit sector before joining Web3. And so when I enter Web3 naively, what I try to do is like, hey guys, look at this technology. There is no intermediaries. This is one of the core principle of the technology. Look what you can do instead of paying, and you were mentioning that, someone in the US and then someone to make the transfer of fund and then someone in Nigeria and someone to bring the cash. There is no intermediary. You can actually send probably 95% of your donation straight to the people. And so what I face is some of organizations were like, wait, but if there is no intermediaries, like how we are actually going to keep our job? People are selfish. Literally, not-for-profit is a business. I learned this the very hard way. But, you know, if you look at how much has been given to this sector for, you know, the past decade, we could have already ended poverty, for example. We did not. And so I think there is so many people benefiting from that. And so there is, you know, when you see a technology that is appearing like that, that will put many people out of that work, I think that's scary. I'm not saying that everybody is like that in the sector, but I think there is people that take advantage of this. And then I will think in the same way, the risk. Some organizations are really willing to kind of, you know, jump on the blockchain space. They want to leverage the technology. They see this as a massive solution for their user. But in most of the country, you know, it's still unregulated. And so if they are taking the risk, what can happen to them in terms of donation, in terms of reputation? Like, what is the benefit and what can come after them? So that's kind of like, the sense that I had. It's still pushing. I think we still have a lot to do in terms of education. But I don't see those traditional kind of institution leveraging the technology until, you know, there is regulation.
Yes, maybe. And it comes back to your point, Katja. There's the problem of ticking the box. You do an event about green finance. You say you've done this and this project. You put women on stage because women sell it better. Everybody's happy. And then at the end of the day, you say, we did it, and you go back to your normal business life. And this is an issue. And this is why public blockchain is a great opportunity to show that public money is well spent. So this is, I think we should push for this. We should be more willing to push for this. And you were talking about mandates. That's very true. But that's a very, very classic public sector answers. Not my mandate. Like UN, not my jurisdiction. Like where people can die to 200 meters away, but it's not your jurisdiction. And we need to push political will And for this, there's only one way in democracy, is that the people ask for more transparency about public funding. So it will take time, but I think we have a great opportunity to get more transparency. I'm not talking about privacy and private transactions. This is another thing. And this is something we should really push, and we should be more, sorry for my English, but exigeant, like demanding on this.
About the public sector matter you just mentioned, we have the pleasure to welcome Christophe de Bekeler, which is a member of the Brussels Parliament. And maybe, Christophe, you can jump into the conversation, but by saying to us the way you envision the tokenization of the public sector and the bridge we can build between this.
Yes, hi everybody, and sorry for my late arrival. So it'll be difficult to to jump in because I don't know what you already talked about. My views on the decentralized financial world is a view of financial freedom. I think that's one of the big topics that will come in the coming years or maybe decades. It will take some time, but in a world that is increasingly digitalizing, we will face a problem of financial freedom. You all know the examples of the truckers in Canada and or the women in Afghanistan or in Iran that has their bank accounts cut, because their access cut to their bank accounts because the government was not aligned with their position or their political positions. These are very small examples in very specific countries, but I think in a world that is more and more digitalizing, we will face those problems more and more. And at that moment, the idea of a financial counterpower, we will see this as a very important need for the citizens. So that's one of the aspects. The other aspect, and I heard you were talking about it, is more about the transparency of some public financing. That will be also one of the main topics, I think, for the main benefits of decentralized financial world tomorrow. So that are two big topics, but maybe it's better that I contribute to the discussion when I hear the other ones talking.
Thank you. We have a question here.
Thank you. Teresa from Funding the Commons. We were talking about system change, different problems with money. The topic is P2P money for good. So I'm wondering, for good, isn't it better sometimes not to get money involved at all? And what I mean by that is, you know, for example, liquidity blockage is a real problem for small businesses, you know, cannot pay you until they pay me and all that, and creates a real issue. And there are people creating things like multilateral credit clearing, barter systems, mesh credit networks, you know, under the roof, what they call collaborative finance, CoFi. So I'm wondering if anyone is also working on solutions like these, or what do you think about pushing for solutions like these a little more?
Yeah, like the project that comes to mind, and I invite everyone to take a look at them as well. Like, they're building on Celo. Their name is like Grassroots Economics. Basically, because you're right, no? Like, the current financial system and like fiat money has a lot of issues, problems. But like, admit it, like, we should, you know, I worked in the central bank before, and so like, you know, fiat money is like a powerful instrument to organize the economy, to allocate value. There's like differences there, but like, it's a tool. But going back to Grassroots Economics, what they do is basically create a system that reflects the practices of like traditional communities. Basically, like, they operate in rural Kenya, and the system there is, for example, I raise cattle, and Jessica, my neighbor, produces rice. we create an agreement like in 3 months, as you produce like 3 sacks of rice, I can give you 2 cattles now. You give me 3 sacks of rice in exchange. And it's a valid transaction because I need carbohydrates. She probably and her family needs protein. And for many, many years, like even centuries before like the current capitalist system, this is how like communities organize, no? And so like the innovation of like grassroots economics is like to use blockchain technology, one, to have like a, you know, stronger record or to facilitate that transaction, to digitalize that. And like everyone probably here could imagine the value of like digitalization here. But the innovation is like, okay, these communities, traditional communities, have this or adhere to these practices, but there are other communities elsewhere in another part of Kenya or like you know, in other parts of the continent, and there's a benefit of like these vouchers, they call it vouchers, community vouchers, to be exchanged and like create a market for it. So that's a long answer to like it's possible. I guess like philosophically it means like how do we program money to reflect what we need and to reflect what we value. Because at the end of the day, that's what money is for. Like in the capitalist system, we need profit. Like we choose profit, and so like we program money to be kind of like endlessly like creating this profit. Is there a world? And I think like this is where blockchain comes in to like reinvent this, to reprogram money, to like disrupt it. And like my answer is yes, but like we need to innovate and like create systems around it.
Just to add to that, I think, you know, mutual credit is really interesting because mutual credit is actually how we collaborated for thousands and thousands of years before the existing financial system. The challenge is trust and scale, right? So in organizations where, or in a world where you live in a village and you know everyone, there's no need for a credit card, right? Because you are already operating within a system of social pressure where you trust one another, and that shared context actually creates the trust for credit. Now, one of the core opportunities, and I think one of the most interesting areas where blockchain over time is going to be able to have a real impact here, is actually answering the question of how do you trust someone you don't know, right? And how do you extend the concepts of mutual credit to support networks of millions, if not billions, of people, right? And this is one of the areas where digital identity actually has the potential to, you know, in concert with decentralized money, really change how we collaborate within communities and across communities on a large scale, right? So I think it's less, the question for me isn't like, should we move away from money itself? It's actually how are we thinking about innovating on how we create more trust, right? So in blockchain, we like to talk about trustlessness. Like, no, more trust. We want more trust, actually, because it's the trust that's what enables us to say, like, okay, pay me in 2 weeks, take the toothpaste, right? And that's where I think things will actually get really quite interesting, is when you have stronger, more robust tools for digital identity that enable people to really have an online, proven, trusted, private reputation that qualifies them as good candidates, right, for mutual credit, and enables that to expand outside of a neighborhood or a community context, but actually to a more global capital context.
Omar from Cabrit Capital. I know we're at ETHCC, but I'm going to step into the temporary role of a non-toxic Bitcoin maximalist. And I know that we're talking about peer-to-peer money. We've touched on stable coins. We've touched on the alternative crypto assets and. Of course, stablecoin-based approaches can help people in difficult environments, like you've mentioned in Lebanon. But the flip side of that is that these stablecoins are basically a Trojan course for the respective financial system that they represent. So the U.S. financial system or the Chinese financial system in the case of the digital yuan. So what is the alternative to this when you look at the crypto asset landscape today? Bitcoin, regardless of whether you think it's well designed or horribly designed, is the only currency that has achieved monetary network effects to a significant degree across the world. So I would put the question to the panelists, like what role does Bitcoin play in peer-to-peer money?
Thank you. It's a very good question because there are two main risks, and you mentioned it. With stablecoins, basically, we buy T-bills. So we inflate the dollar. And we could be the perfect...
Maybe you can clarify.
Yes, T-bills is a monetary product. Basically, you buy a loan to the U.S. state for a certain period of time, and it gives you an interest. It's a very liquid product. Everybody is buying it. States are buying it. And the stablecoin issuer are buying it. But makes us a perfect scapegoat if there is a problem. You say, they took risk on T-bills. There are spreads on our products. This is the crypto guys. So this is a real danger I foresee, and we should kind of clarify the situation with this. And the second thing is that the current financial system and the BIS, and I know it's one of my favorite topics with Raoul. The BIS was co-created by one of the money guy of Hitler, so which is a great track record. And in 1944, you had a wire from the Bundesbank to the Federal Reserve during the war for payment of interest. So I think we can have a better financial system. And when people are, like when the Financial Stability Board is kind of accusing crypto of every crime in the world, it's good to remind them where they were at this point. So yes, I totally agree with you. There is a better financial system to build, and we don't have moral lesson to receive. But the problem is that this system is quite powerful for now and has gone through many crises. 2008 was a great change. I mean, I was working in a bank. I think you can testify. People were really lost, like really, really lost. But the problem is that nobody understood how the financial system really worked. So we couldn't even blame it. We couldn't even demonstrate against it because it was too complex. Crypto educates us to understand it better. So maybe next time we will have a better answer. It's a very personal opinion. It's not the opinion of the bank. But
well, I'd love to add on that. I think what you said, what Basel said also, I think our system is at least growing older and showing some cracks. Obviously, there's still a lot of push factors that needs to bring the baker towards maybe another monetary system than the dollar or the euro. And I think this is a great example of what we can expect. And I'm wondering also, like Lebanon is one example, but if the same happens, hyperinflation happens in the US or in Europe, what's going to be the reserve currency in this case? It's not going to be the dollar or the euro. So to get back to your question, I think Bitcoin is a great example. Still, a problem of PR. People, when you say Bitcoin, it's quite a dirty word for a lot of people. I'm also a bit of an old school guy. I like gold. I think we've got more and more digital gold tokens or also silver. So I think I'd hope for liquidity and popularity of these to come up because I'd be interested maybe one day, you know, like our grandparents did and they stored gold under their bed. Maybe one day we'll have gold tokens, and these are quite neutral in a way. They're less political.
Depends who holds the actual gold.
Yeah. That's true as well. Well, not Europe anymore.
Yeah. I'll
jump in.
Let's imagine our a currency based on credit system as a body disease, an autoimmune disease, where you have to cut your feet and then another feet, and then your leg to protect your head. And the fiat system currently is, we are not even, we have we didn't even yet start it, like the crypto revolution or the blockchain revolution or the trust and the collaboration, new form of DAOs and human collaboration. We didn't even start it because we have not passed the step where the fiat system is actually shrinking to its head, and the head is the dollar. So maybe it's like fiction, but in many countries you mentioned, Argentina, Turkey, Iran also, Venezuela, Bitcoin isn't replacing the local currency, that's the dollar. So if you have like a pyramidal scheme based on interest debt in all the country of the world, at the end of the day, all your currency disappear and you shrink the Ponzi scheme to the top of the pyramid, which is the dollar. So we are going to more dollarization and not crypto, not yet. But I agree that we have to think about the next step for like after the collapse, yeah, because there is too much resistance to change currently. I was mentioning the baker or the local store, but it's all about incentives. We cannot force people to use like cryptocurrency and instead of a fiat currency or unstable coin, because it's based on unstable fiat. We cannot force people to do that unless they start to realize that the main topic is still, and again, who control the money, how the money is distributed, what kind of design you want for your currency. For example, when I talk to friends, they say, do you have Bitcoin? Yeah, maybe, yeah. Do you spend it? It's raising in the long run. It's 15 years. It has improved in value. Why should I spend something that is like a diamond or gold? I won't spend it. It's just a best money. So, and if it's the contrary for fiat currency, people will spend it. That's the law of game theory. So, we have to imagine what kind of currency we want. If we want to protect saving in the long run, it should be an improving currency, but no one will spend it, so you won't have growth and a dynamic economy. Or if you want to protect consumers, and you have a money that is losing value step by step.
I think I'll chime in really quickly on a practical sense, right? Like Bitcoin for sure is like the OG of like crypto, but at the end of the day, it's also very important to take note, like it must be programmable, or like it should be easy to program. Like that's the reason why you have tons of L1s, other alternatives, L2s, and like their premise basically is like, oh, we want to help builders use the tool, because essentially you can take the perspective like crypto assets are like the tool, no? But like, what's the house that will use that tool, or whatever metaphor that you want. And like, I think that's the essential difficulty. Maybe like the industry has kind of like progressed, like it's relatively, like there are more innovation now that allows you to build dApps, financial products, etc. on Bitcoin, but it's still hard. Like I think he was referring to it, like to transfer Bitcoin from one person to the other, the gas fees are still like ridiculous. And like for P2P, that's like unimaginable, right? And so I guess like in terms of like imagining like how crypto in general will create this financial system, like at the foundation, our goal is like, how do we help builders? How do we help the entrepreneurs to apply these tools? And like, what's the best way for them not only to find the fit for the users that they're building for, but also for them to reach the scale and like the adoption that we want to see? I think like that's putting the vision into practice. Like how do you empower the builders?
I actually think that crypto has really lost its way in terms of remembering what's fun or interesting about this special type of decentralized ledger technology and the types of information that it stores. Bitcoin's a great invention. I think everyone here in this room probably believes that. It's a shit form of money, right? Like, depending on if we're talking about circulation. No one here is going to spend their Bitcoin. And so it comes back to the question of, because it's deflationary and because of how it's performed, and so it's only rational that people would, of course, want to keep it and spend the depreciating currency, which is actually dollars, right? Or fiat currency. I think that, you know, the emergence of the focus on stable coins is actually in many ways reactionary to regulation and what happened in the early days of cryptocurrency in the ICO boom and the perception of how much harm that caused for retailers, for retail investors who were promised new types of money and new types of tokens and new types of incentives and basically end up, you know, losing and eating it, right? And so at least in the United States, this like backlash towards stable coins and away from a lot of the true experimentation, which was focused off of building new types of incentive systems, right? Like, how do you create, how do you make a dollar in actually result in $1.50 out? Well, it's like leverage that's based off of a certain type of incentives and behaviors that you're trying to incentivize, but there isn't a lot of space to experiment with that when you have the US government hovering over you and threatening to sue with a class action suit every single entrepreneur. So I think where we are is really an intermediary phase, if you will, between what the big narrative was, what the big potential was to actually discuss and innovate around what programmable money is and how individuals and communities can orient around accepting a certain level of risk that's linked to those incentives. It's not Bitcoin, it's not stable coins, it's something in between. And what we see today is actually Bitcoin is, it's like the worst of both worlds, right? Because it's like you're looking for the most volatile asset possible, meme coins from this past round, right? People are looking for the highest appreciation possible. They'll take any risk. And at the end, they want to move it into USDC, right? So that is just like a real spotlight on the, you know, financial nihilism. But I think it will pass, right? Because people are getting smarter about what money is, what exchange is, how we collaborate, and new generations and new entrepreneurs will actually be able to embrace this technology in a new way to create new types of currencies, like actual currencies, right? That circulate maybe not on a nation state level, but amongst certainly individuals. But it will be an evolution, not a revolution.
Like CBDCs?
No. No, more of the same. I think it will really happen due to communities that have a shared interest, right? It will happen because of affinity groups that have real problems to solve for themselves. Probably a lot of that will actually start with, my guess is a lot of that will start with the environment, right? And as different communities face different environmental climate crises right at their front door, there's going to, you know, the communities are going to have to protect themselves. And that in and of itself will create an impetus to develop new types of incentives and new types of money. And but again, that's a 50-year project.
Yes. Or maybe a last reaction it's a good question. Your question is very difficult to answer because at the end of the day, it depends on the use cases. You said that already. Well, what are the use cases for Bitcoin today? Of course, it was imagined, and it's brilliant. Can you imagine a token? It's peer-to-peer, it's digital, and maximum 21 million. Based, there is nothing nothing else exists with those kind of characteristics. You might say, okay, digital, there are lots of things that are digital. Peer-to-peer, of course, even cash today, my euros is peer-to-peer. I can do a lot of things with 10 euro, for example. But the combination of the three, it's extremely, powerful. Powerful. Okay, that's the use case for payments. Well, but then it depends on the context. Why should you pay in Bitcoin in continental Europe? The current system is very developed. It's digital. It's okay. It's even if there is high inflation or low inflation, you're just able to do that. And then there is another use case emerging. It's the store of value, digital gold. Will it work? Yes or no? Well, there are lots of examples of étalons de valeur who failed. So nobody knows. And then linked to that, in traditional finance and asset management, people talk about diversification of portfolios. And the same way the lots of asset managers used to advise and still advise to keep a small proportion of gold in a diversified portfolio, 0.01% if you don't like it, and 10% or more if you like it, then some asset manager starts saying the same. So those are the two use cases. Will it work? Nobody knows, and this is why it's impossible to justify the current price. Or you can say, well, it's worth today, I don't know, $55,000. Why? Maybe there is 5.5% of the population who think that it's worth 1 million and 94.5% thinking it was zero. And then you do the math, and it's worth that. But it's not a justification. So we don't know. And to conclude, it's true that it can have the characteristic of money, and it could be an étalon de valeur and so on. But when it's the case, by the way, it will be too late. It will not appreciate. It will not be volatile anymore. So that's the issue right now. I fear it's not an answer to your question, but there are lots of issues relating to that, and it's an excellent question. Thank you.
There's only questions. In the end, the question is, do we need an alternative to the fiat system, and what's the likeliest alternative to the fiat system?
And ask people from Lebanon, having lost all of their money, so the ones who were lucky or very smart were the ones who had dollars. It is what you said, dollars. Or complementary things such as real assets and some of them Bitcoin, but maybe it's too soon, as you said. So,
at the question of the alternative, I think we need. I'm a politician, and I see in politics, if you have only one power, if you have only the parliament of only or only the government or only the judiciary in power, it's very dangerous. And we are entering a world also with digitalization, because before digitalization, the cash plays a certain role of counterpower. Not totally, but a certain role. But now, more and more, there is one central power in the financial system, and that's dangerous. So maybe we need an alternative only to be sure the real power, the fiat system, is being well managed and better managed than it is now. So I think the alternative finance that we are creating here has also one goal, is to améliorer, is to improve the fiat system.
So when you mean real power, you were not talking about the Belgian parliament or the French government. You mean central banks?
Yeah.
Okay.
But is there still a real difference?
Yeah.
Is there still a real difference?
There is. It's not that it's the same. It's a relation of dominated and dominating. So before it was money of people, then money of kings, and then it shifts in the Middle Age to money of traders, and traders organized their pyramid schemes. Because you cannot have a scheme based on infinite growth that can repay the infinite growth of credit. So the structure of the financial system is going to the ground. It's not a trend. It's the structure of your system. The system cannot work. That's the real reason the Amsterdam Wisselbank was created in the 17th century, because when you create too much money, you have to have someone to buy all the, sorry for the world, for the shit. So the real task of the central bank is not to prevent inflation, is to buy everything that is IOU that has zero value in all the financial system. And we are getting closer. So
It's true. French history is a good reminder. You had Fouquet, that was kind of the money man of the king. And at some point he was like, I feel so powerful, I have all the money. But at that time the king said, put this guy in prison. And it worked.
Exactly.
The problem now is that we're not sure if we can put a central banker in prison. So that's a good question.
I think the topic of money is too serious to be let in the end of the private sector. I think it should be public again. It's not public currently. People think it's the state. But if you think on, system dynamics, effect, cause and effect, and the feedback loop, you imagine world like cube in a cube in a cube. You have like your public policy. For example, I want to have health policy in Bruxelles, and how will I fund my hospitals? This is a public policy, but you need the public funding, which is the law of finance of the Belgian parliament. But this cube is inside the monetary euro cube. So this is cause and effect. And if you want to have a real impact on your future, you need to take back the power of currency. People decided to do that in 2009 with the Genesis Block, but still, depending on the culture of countries, people still in many countries, for example, maybe less in Switzerland or in other countries or Belgium, I don't know, but in France we rely to the political signal. So it has to be the political responsible who decide to say, okay, there are a lot of abuse in one way. Maybe we should give more power to the people as validators of the financial system. But it will be on the long run. I just want to just, she's gone, but if we can have a system of currency, but not based on money, I think it's when times are rough, people usually exchange directly goods and services locally, but as you mentioned, it's not scalable, but you have now the technology to make it scalable with digital networks. But I think that's just personal thinking. In the long run, it's not like there is 21 million coins or there is 80 million coins. My model is better than yours. I think the best model should be local fit, so you won't have one beacon to rule them all, or one ether to rule them all. You will have several currencies fit to the local productivity, but not based on monetary units, but based on unit of times, because you cannot cheat on time. If I, you mentioned the chair, if I say the chair was built, it's worth 20 hours of labor. You know it's worth 20 hours of labor. You cannot create hour, so you cannot cheat. So if you have a local currency based on time, it already exists on local currencies, which are not crypto. But I think if crypto merge with local currencies, using the time that is needed to build or to create a good or a service, you have a currency that is most better resilience.
Okay. Can I just bounce back on that?
Sure, and okay. Then we take the last question.
Okay. So I'm Jordan from Decolent. I'm glad that you mentioned this because it leads to the question I was about to ask: is how do we pilot an economy with peer-to-peer monies? So if you have a plethora of different peer-to-peer currencies, how can a government can monitor and can pilot an economy?
Never the government. I'm sorry, I work for the government, but I have to be like humble. It's never the government who decide what is money and what is not. The government just sign at the end of the paper, because if you have Venezuela trying to create his digital currency, it fails. At the end of the day, the network effect, money is network effect of social sign. I have a service to you. You have a good to me. We take we can use any sign, any social sign in the middle. But you have to be able to check it. So we decide what money is. And in the long run, yes, you still have sanction. You can have the threats from a central government and go in jail if you don't use the official government currency. Yes, it's true.
but the law is not has not infinite power. At the end of the day, it's the social norm that makes the legal the law. The law is a consequence of the social norm, not the contrary. You cannot go eternally towards your people. That's not possible. People always cheat. If they want to cheat, they can cheat.
Thank you, Akli. I keep in mind that money is the definition we can we have, actually, and we decided to have. So thank you very much for all the guests. Thank you for all the Blockchain for Good team and organizer. Thank you, Jacques André, especially. It was a beautiful day, and we can have a drink to finish it properly. Thank you. Ah, yes, it is good dollar happy hour, and thank you for this.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I'll just say that we are, Good Dollar is probably the largest peer-to-peer digital monetary experiment that's out there currently that's based on bottom-up economies. So it's very fitting that we're sponsoring this happy hour, and I recommend you check it out.